RN. Follow us on Twitter at Radio National.
Hello there, Natasha Mitchell, welcoming you to Life Matters, an hour ahead, fantastic stuff. Hey, here's a number to blow your mind. 1.3 billion tonnes. That's a third of the world food produced for consumption by us each year, according to a figure from the UN Environment Programme. You see, that is the amount of food that gets lost or wasted or thrown out each year. And every year, consumers in wealthy countries like our own waste almost as much food as the entire net food production of sub-Saharan Africa. What are we going to do about that? What are you going to do about that? On the show, we'll meet a French politician, effectively a councillor in Paris, who decided he was going to do something about that. He made this his local issue within a year of being elected. Within 4 months, he has managed to convince France to pass a law banning supermarkets from throwing out food that is otherwise edible. It's an incredible feat. And we're also going to meet an Australian chef who's using fresh food that's too often destined for landfill in this country as the ingredients on his menu. Looking forward to that. Look, yesterday we compared the welfare policies of New Zealand's Conservative government and Australia's. New Zealand has decided to invest in those most in need with increased welfare payments in their latest budget. And we got some calls in response. Here is one of them.
Hi, Michelle from Adelaide calling. I had heard a few weeks ago that when New Zealand put some changes through around female work participation, that there was large discussion with the community and with people in New Zealand. They informed the debate. However, here in Australia, we made changes that affect women on a day-to-day basis 8 years ago without actually telling anyone. They were made, Gillard brought them in, one on the misogynist speech day, the other one was when she apologised for stealing, when they stole parent children in the 60s. So they're the 2 days that insults to women's rights came in, and they've only just unfolded as the Liberal government have found that that's an easy target, no one knew about it. And now women are in relationships, they could be in a domestic violence situation, and they don't realise that they're choosing between financial suicide or staying and getting bashed or potentially killed. So these policies, it's not encouraging women to work, to put more pressure onto them and to put them into dangerous situations which are fueled by lack of money that's taken away by the government and causing domestic violence. The initial reason they brought in the payment, tax A, was to help people with the cost of raising a child. They're trying to attack that. They're also trying to attack family tax B, which was for single parent families who can't afford to live as it is. So these cuts are going to make people homeless. Once people are homeless, you can't get Centrelink. What is the path here? They're trying to push people into homelessness and to just starve to death. I can't understand it.
Michelle making a whole lot of connections, her response to the latest budget here in Australia. Yesterday with our Everyday Economist, we talked to Peter Martin about GST, what should be or shouldn't be in it. You might recall on Q&A on Monday night on ABC TV, a campaign got some airtime to get the GST off tampons. Here's a response to that discussion yesterday.
With the GST coming under scrutiny yet again, especially about the ridiculous imposition of GST on tampons, it's about time somebody looked at the concept of value addition and value subtraction taxation. What we call GST is called value added tax in many countries, and one of the first candidates for a value subtraction tax should be the amount of sucrose added to breakfast cereals, fast food and stuff like that. And it would be quite easy. You simply calculate the proportion of the weight of the product represented by added sucrose, and you then add that same proportion of the final retail price to the current retail price. For example, an $8 box of cornflakes with two-thirds of its weight represented by added sucrose, you would then add $2.50 or something to the price of the pack, making it $10.50. There'd be a lot of people eat a lot less heavily sugared cereal, for example, and that could be hypothecated into a special fund for treating the obesity epidemic. Give that one a try. It might fly or it might not. I think big junk food would howl like a wounded cat.
Oh, there you go. Big junk food howling like a wounded cat. What do you think of that one? Maybe you'd like to get in touch. Well, look, you can ring us on any of our stories, 0283 1430. But if you are the parent of a child with autism, listen up next and be part of the conversation. Stay with us. We all have different communication styles, but what if you have a child with autism, or indeed you're an adult living with autism, and you've been described, categorised, named, labelled as non-verbal or minimally verbal? What are the ways in which you access the world and the world accesses you? If that's the case, this is the case for a lot of young people on the autistic spectrum. And in the past, it might have been assumed that you would remain mute, that words weren't going to be the way that you communicated. But increasingly, it's understood now that many children can and will develop some verbal skills, perhaps a lot of verbal skills, with the right early intervention and therapy. What's essential? And in getting in early, and are enough children getting the right interventions at the right time? And if not, what does that mean for your child's ability to thrive if they are nonverbal? If you have a child who is minimally or nonverbal with autism, we'd really like to hear from you this morning. 1300 22 55 76 or 1300 call RN. You can SMS us 0418 226 576 or tweet us at RN Life Matters. If you're in WA, go for our listener line, 0283 1430. What interventions or therapies have helped your child thrive? I'll be interested to know. And without words, have you found other important ways to communicate with your child or to access their experience of the world? Give us a call, 1300 22 55 76. Three guests in the know joining us this morning. We've got Dr. Giacomo Vivanti. He's a research fellow at the Olga Tennison Autism Research Centre based at La Trobe University. His current research focuses on teaching children with autism and the impact of early intervention. Good morning to you, Giacomo.
Good morning.
Great to have you with us. Christine Kendall is joining us in the Melbourne studios too, Director of Spectrum Speech Pathology. She's a speech language pathologist. She's worked with children on the autism spectrum for over 20 years now. Good morning, Christine.
Good morning, Natasha.
And Dr. Nancy Sadka knows this personally. She's a mother of two sons living with autism, James, who's 22, and Andrew, who's 8. Both are non-verbal or minimally verbal, and she also works in the early assessment clinic at the Olga Tennison Autism Research Centre. Great to have you with us, Nancy.
Good morning. How are you?
Very well. Giacomo, when people say non-verbal or minimally verbal in the context of autism, what do they mean?
Well, the perspective changed a lot in the past 10 years. We used to think that 50% of children with autism will be verbal and 50% will be nonverbal, never be able to talk. And now we know that those figures are not accurate. Many children who might be nonverbal when they're 18 months or 24 months, they will develop language if they are diagnosed early and if they go through well-established early intervention program. They can learn language.
Giacomo, why are some children verbal and some not? And of course, the experience of autism is so diverse. There are so many different individual manifestations of autism. But do we understand what is happening for a child who is minimally or non-verbal?
We don't fully understand why different children present with different severity of symptoms to start with. But what we understand is that when a number of skills or a number of behaviors are not there, like joint attention, for example, or spontaneous imitation or emotion sharing or sharing of affect, when that basic
sharing of emotion.
Yeah, that's right. Mm. When that basic infrastructure of social communication and emotional connectedness is not there, then often language is not there either. And if we change that, and if we engage the child in meaningful and rewarding social interaction, and we use that as a framework to teach language, language can emerge, and in many cases will emerge for many children.
Because, of course, if we think evolutionarily, language is such an inextricable part of how we communicate socially.
That's correct, yeah. Mm.
To what extent does a child's inability to speak also affect their ability to learn and comprehend language?
Well, if children cannot speak, they will be constantly exposed to frustration. Imagine how frustrated you will be if you are in a country where you don't know the language, you don't understand the rules, you don't understand what's going on. You have no power to make things happen around you. So things just happen without you having any ability to affect other people's behavior. It will create a sense of frustration and usually result in emotional dysregulation and challenging behaviors as well.
Yeah, so it's all tied, isn't it? And do people make assumptions about a child's cognitive or intellectual capacity if they are nonverbal? Can we make any connections there?
Well, it's really hard to understand the cognitive functioning of someone who is nonverbal because it is difficult to test them using the standardized tools that we use to measure things like IQ and so on. What we see is that if we go beyond the traditional approaches to test IQ and we looked at things like spontaneous behavior, spontaneous initiation, or using nonverbal means to communicate, we can understand that many children who are nonverbal, they are motivated to communicate and they have a complex and enriched emotional life. At the same time, we need to improve our ways to assess, to test, and also to intervene with children who cannot communicate in a traditional or in a conventional way.
Ah, yes, and that's key, isn't it? This morning on Life Matters, we are talking about the experience of autism. And if you're listening, we'd love you to be part of this conversation. Particularly, we're focusing on the experience of children who are non-verbal or minimally verbal with autism. This is a great challenge for those children and particularly for parents, and perhaps you are a parent of a child in that situation, because communication is how you relate. It's how relationships form, and it can be very, very challenging for parents. And I wonder how you have managed to communicate with your child. What therapies and interventions have helped your child thrive in that situation? Give us a call, 1300 225 76, or 1300 call RM. Perhaps you have a question for one of our guests this morning. Dr. Nancy Sadker is with us too. The experience of your two sons being verbal and or minimally verbal, what was that like for you early on?
So with Andrew, who is actually now 23 almost, when he was very young and right before his diagnosis, he started banging his head on the floor because he couldn't communicate with me. I could see his frustration, and I could anticipate that he's trying to tell me something, but he couldn't. And as a parent, you know, that's probably the worst feeling you can get, is because you cannot communicate with your child. And also you have that sinking feeling in your heart that your child would never be able to look at you and call you and say mama. And for me, that was, you know, very, very wrenching at that time. And I remember, you know, going through that. So I had to find a way back then, 20 years ago, when intervention was scarce, on how to communicate with him and how to release that tension that he had in his life.
And it's a very big journey for you. What were the key turning points for you?
I think that the first thing I needed to do for him is to make him aware that I am there for him. And what I did was, when he was very, very young, I used to take his hand when he would be frustrated and put it against my cheek. And when I did that, I taught him that he needed to look and turn around and look at me, which is the basic of communication. The first thing you do is you look in somebody's face, you look in somebody's eyes. And by doing that, I was able to turn the tide for him. And when he looked at me, even if he didn't use his words, it meant I need to say something. And I would stop then and try to look and listen to his body language in order to find out what he wanted.
And what has been that body language? What are the ways that you have communicated non-verbally?
Yep. So for him, he had a range of facial expressions. So he could show me when he was happy. He could show me when he was sad. He had a grin on his face. His demeanor would change. The way he moved his body, the way he rocked, or the way he leaned forward. So if he was very happy, for example, he would lean forward and he would look at me very quickly and then turn his eyes and look at the object he wanted. And by doing that, he was telling me, "Mom, I will be very happy if I would take that." And that was a key point in understanding his body language. And as he grew older, all those subtle signs became more evident, and we were able to do a profile around him in order to understand him. And just to capitalize on what Dr. Vivanti was saying, Giacomo, that now Andrew at 22 and a half, he can say yes and no. When they told me back then, because he couldn't talk, he had an intellectual disability, and back then they used to say mental retardation. But now he can say yes and no.
And that is a fundamental transformation, isn't it? Because that's the key expression of need.
Of course, and because it opens up his life towards choices, towards what he wants, towards a better environment, towards support, and he now is out in the community and he can live his life to the fullest with support, because he can make choices, he can show you what he wants and what he doesn't want.
I'll come back to you and I'll come back to Christine Kendall in just a moment. Let's take some calls. You're ringing in. Bernadette in Canberra, you're a full-time carer. Your eldest son has autism.
Yes, he does, and he missed the boat on early intervention, or should I say appropriate intervention.
Yes.
Because it does need to be evidence-based. But I just want to make the point that you should never give up, because he's actually learning to read now, and it is a slow process, but, you know, with brain plasticity, any age, any stage, give it your best shot.
And where is he at now?
Well, he's learning to read and he's a lot more confident and he's speaking more. Ironically, he spoke quite a bit when he was a lot more when he was a young child. There was little to no eye contact. But we did a lot of singing. You know, I love music and I had the idea that language could be taught through singing, another area of the brain, and there was quite a bit of that going on. But he has extremely sensitive hearing, and I have for a very long time had the theory that his own voice, the vibration in his own head, actually causes him some level of distress, because he can hear me from about two or three rooms away. And I don't think that's an uncommon story.
And have you found ways of communicating with him that are non-verbal?
Oh, absolutely. But I'm more alongside, you know, there's no... he used to draw. And again, as your previous caller said, you know, body language is quite a key. And ironically, when he was really distressed, he would actually be smiling. So when he was smiling, he was really freaked out.
And you had to tap into that.
I had to tap into it. Yes. And when there was very little emotion was when he was at his calmest.
Wow, there you go. It's all about learning another language, isn't it? Bernadette, thank you so much for the call. And never give up.
Okay, bye.
Thank you. Bye. Adrienne in Sydney, good morning to you. You run an arts program for adults with autism, and as part of that, adults who are non-verbally autistic.
Yes, not just for autism. It's for a whole spectrum of intellectual disability and physical. And every 6 months, they go on a stage, a professional stage, and perform. And every time people come there, they're absolutely moved by who they are. Particularly some of the people that I work with that have autism, I could be working with them for 2 years and get nothing, which is similar to the experience the previous caller said. But then suddenly, you keep creating, you keep standing for them to connect, and suddenly they will just get up and they will sing. They will sing in front of an audience and completely blow people away. And I think it's never to give up. Be patient. And music, to me personally, music is the key to some of the people with nonverbal to have them engage with other people, especially when it's joyful. It's a song they know, like they've heard before, they can connect to. And that's the environment that a lot of these people are going to excel.
Oh, Adrienne, what a fantastic call. If you could stay on the line, we'll get your number. That would be great. Thank you for the call. Lindy, in northern Queensland, you're a special ed teacher.
Yes, my main area is working with students with autism, and I've been doing it for nearly 20 years. And one of the best things that ever happened to me was about 12 years ago when I had a student who came into the high school. I work with high school students who was nonverbal and autistic, and he I could see that he had the shining intelligence behind his eyes. It just, I could feel it in him. And I organized for him to get a black box communicator, which is images, they're little symbols, and it's 12 per layer. And I got a teenage boy equivalent, age equivalent, to record for each image a message, such as if there was one image, it would say, "I am bored, please go away," or "I need to go to," the next one would be, "I need to go to the toilet," or "I am enjoying this activity," "person next door is annoying me," and just everyday communication that teenagers would use. And I organized this for him, and I showed him how to use it within a couple of months. It took a lot of funding to get the machine from Education Queensland, who very kindly supplied it. And it was wonderful. It opened up this whole experience for him of being able to communicate. And he just would push, "I am bored," and this lesson is really bugging me. He'd push that and just giggle. And it was wonderful being able to give him that ability to communicate, and it opened out a way of him reaching out to people.
Thank you very much, Lindy. That's a very interesting instrument, and we might get back to that. I appreciate the call.
Okay.
This morning we're talking about the experience of living with autism and being nonverbal, the experience of parents. Perhaps you're an adult who's listening in and has had that experience earlier in your life. 1300 225 76. With us is Dr. Giacomo Vivanti, research fellow at the Olga Tennison Autism Research Centre at La Trobe University. Dr. Nancy Sadker is with us. She's a mother of two children with autism who are nonverbal or minimally verbal. Christine Kendall is with us too. Now, she's director of Spectrum Speech Pathology. She specialises in working with people with autism. Kristen, let me come to you. What do you see as your role? What's your goal guiding your work with people who are nonverbal?
Natasha, it's a good question, because people often think that a speech pathologist wouldn't really have a role with children who are nonverbal. What would we be doing with people who can't talk? But in fact, speech pathologists are experts in language and communication. And as Nancy and Giacomo have discussed, and your callers, it's about the communication. And as such, we know how to work with children with autism, those of us that specialise in working with the children. We use the evidence that researchers like Giacomo present to us, and we are very good at working with children who can't talk, but also in developing skills in children who develop their speech as well, so that those children who are going to develop speech actually can do so. And communication is about being social. It is about interaction. It's about engagement. It's about being part of a family. And so our role is to work with families, with their children, and to teach them how to take a lot of this information and a lot of of their skills that they need to develop the children's skills in communicating at home and embedding those sorts of skills in their interactions with their children at home.
So when a child comes to you, I guess, how do you assess where you think you might be able to go with them? Because, of course, you don't want to impose the expectation that speech might come. But if speech is a possibility, then that's wonderful.
As Giacomo indicated before, we would look at the child's joint attention. We look at what they know about communication, because often, for example, I can get children who will come in and when they want a drink, they might just stand in front of the sink, for example, or pace up and down in front of the sink. Mm. But if they're in a different context, so they might be at a playgroup or at grandma's house and they don't know that that's what they're meant to do, they actually can't ask for a drink. So the sorts of things that we would look at is, what does that child understand about communicating and interacting with other people, and gradually develop, work on those skills and teach the parents how to expand those skills. And it may be that we need to do some of that initially in a one-to-one situation in a clinic, but then you're taking it home and expanding it into different situations for the parents.
What about the communication devices that our previous caller mentioned? Then there are a number of different tools and devices that are available.
That's right. And so there are a range of speech pathologists call those alternative and augmentative communication aids. A lot of we know that children with autism are stronger visually often, and so we use those skills initially. We might use photos, we might use objects, we might use pictures, and teach the children how to use those for communication and sometimes to help to understand language. But also we would start to, once they have developed some understanding of interaction and communication, we would perhaps look at using some of those devices. There are dedicated devices that the caller, I think, from Queensland talked about. There are simple ones that are not particularly sophisticated. There are some that are extremely sophisticated and quite generative, so the children can actually construct their own sentences and communication as they've developed more skills. But also what's been marvellous in the last few years is the rise of the iPad, and there are some apps that are being used quite widely with children as well, which has made them more accessible, partly because the voice or the speech generating devices tend to be very expensive, whereas an iPad is a much more affordable option for parents too.
You mentioned communicating via images, and let's take a call from Aline in Sydney. Your 21-year-old son is living with nonverbal autism.
Yes.
And this is key to you, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, we've developed and researched a way of communicating with him, or teaching him to communicate. And we've come up with a very successful tool that we use, a communication tool called Picture Exchange Communication, which I'm sure your speech pathologist knows about. And and it's been very successful. And I really agree with the caller before, Bernadette, to never give up. We never thought that he could communicate with us in a very effective way, but now he can. So, which is lovely. We also basically is trying to get him to go to an iPad, because the picture images make his book that he carries around fairly thick, if you can imagine. He's built up a lot of vocab.
That's right, whereas if it's all stored digitally, yes, that makes it so much easier.
Absolutely. So we're teaching him to learn to use the iPad, but it's not, I mean,
name
of your speech pathologist, but
Christine,
yes. It's actually quite hard to really get the right app for, you know, individualize that for your particular purpose.
Yes.
So we're trying hard to get him to migrate to that.
Aline, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. We're getting a whole lot of very interesting calls on the board. Let me come back to Giacomo of Avanti. As you're listening, I know that you work with a very particular evidence base early on with children there at the Olga Tennison Research Centre. One of the approaches is what's called, a rather unwieldy title, the Early Start Denver Model. What are you looking at there that's key in this conversation about communication?
Well, the Early Start Denver Model is an approach that it was specifically designed for very young children. And it addresses the needs of a child who is 18 months old, for example, or 24 months old. Now, the communication that happens at that age is very different from the communication needs of someone who is older. And therefore, what we do is to use play as a framework where we support those behaviors that I mentioned before: joint attention, social emotional connectedness, spontaneous imitation, reciprocal imitation, and we use those what we call joint activity routines to
give support. Us an example, I guess.
Yeah, for example, you
I mean,
can
I love the idea of a therapy based on play.
Yeah.
Can we have that for the rest of our lives as well?
Well, yeah, and I should say the early start ever model is not at all the only therapy based on play. Well, to give you an example, let's say that you have an 18 months old child who is playing with a cup, with a paper cup, and he's banging the cup on the floor. Then the therapist will position themselves right where the child is so that the child cannot really avoid eye contact with the therapist, and do the same with another paper cup, reciprocal imitation, mm-hmm. and turn this into a turn-taking routine. And then you start narrating what you're doing with very simple language. For example, you can say ready, set, and then when you say go, you start doing that action, the paper cup on the floor.
And a whole lot is going on in that interaction.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, there's a, well, if the child is engaged, and it's likely that the child will be engaged if that action is something that comes from the child, because you're capitalizing on the child's spontaneous interest and behavior rather than telling the child what to do. So once you have that routine going on, you can elaborate, and then you can pause. So instead of saying ready, set, go, you only say ready, set, and you wait. And if you do less, the child will do more. Now, this is something that it's a framework. It's not
prescriptive.
Yeah, exactly. But the basic idea is that engaging the child in routines that are rewarding, that are based on the child's motivation, and where we offer the children choices, do you want to do this or that, that will create a good foundation for language to emerge. But we also need to teach things, and teaching language and teaching behaviors like joint attention, imitation, and so on, involves the very systematic reinforcement or the very systematic rewarding of the child's spontaneous behavior in a way that is playful, that is child-friendly, but is also very rigorous.
Yes. Let's take another call if we can. Rose in Canberra, you have a 29-year-old son. He lives with non-verbal autism. Now, he did something incredible.
Yes, he did. Hi, how are you?
Very well. What happened?
That's good. Absolutely amazing. James actually listens to Happy Feet, which is a very popular movie in the community, and he actually did his first tune, because some of my family have been very gifted, like musically, and my daughter sings, and when my mum was alive, she sung beautifully, and he sang his first tune.
He sang his first song at 29.
Happy Feet, like to do with the ice, and he's actually also said, the little Happy Feet penguin also said, I'm freezing. So James looked at me and he said, I'm freezing, because it's to do with the snow. But he sang his da-da-da-da-da-da-da, like it's the first tune. Like, my daughter was excellent with music. She would be able to do this really well. But it was his first tune, and I'm absolutely amazed, because he absolutely loves music. So it was
How did he I can hear how you felt about this.
It was amazing.
How do you think he felt about that?
Well, he actually keeps doing it now with the carers when they come into my home in the morning. He's actually, because I was standing there with my mouth open in absolute amazement, he's actually started to sing it in the bath, the same tune.
Brilliant.
With the carers, so the carers actually sang the same tune as well. But we're actually both participants of the National Disability Insurance Scheme.
Right. Well, that's an important. Well, that's a whole other story. Rose, thank you so much for the call. Wonderful to hear from you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
You might get a little sick of that song, Happy Feet, in time. Maybe he might need to change his repertoire if he's lucky. We'll squeeze in one more call. Martin, you're a physiotherapist in Sydney.
Yes, I am. Yes, this is a question for Dr. Avanti from Latrobe. I don't have a particular interest in autism, but I do teach kids grappling and judo. And we started a class recently, and a couple of autism kids, these are from kids from 5 to 8, were in the actual class. And I was teaching them motor skills. And it was really interesting observing the autistic child and how beneficial learning those motor skills, such as rolling, falling, grabbing hold of other children in a playful environment, and watching how anxious the parents were. And I thought, you know, these kids could really benefit from these motor skills that they could learn from grappling and judo. And I just wondered if there's been any research done in that sort of area, because it's an area where I think it may help kids who are nonverbal learning motor skills help.
All right. Thank you, Martin, very much. We're running out of time. I'll just get a quick comment from Giacomo on that.
Basically, I fully agree that targeting motor skills is very important for children or adults with autism, and that if you build any when I talk about engagement with the child, it's social engagement, but it's also motor engagement. It's doing things together and doing things that engage your body and engage a reciprocal communication. And if you're learning something, there is also reciprocal imitation. All of that create a very good foundation for learning new skills.
And Nancy Sadker, I wonder how your approach now has changed. Andrew's nearly 23, James is around 8, I think. How your approach has changed with your two sons?
Well, with my youngest son, James, we were able to get him into early intervention when he was almost 4 years old. Unfortunately, you know, early intervention is very expensive and it's not readily available. And we actually did the ESDM model, and it made such a huge impact, because the first thing he was taught was to point. And once he started to point, he started requesting with pointing and looking, and he started adding words. He developed a little bit of echolalia, so he started repeating words. And that by itself changed the quality of his life.
Right.
Because now frustration is gone. 90% of the behavior is gone, is out of the window. And we're reaping the results, because he can find a way, and we're pushing for language more than trying to do other things with him at now. For example, the other day he kept on telling me, spin it, spin it. And I said, you know, I don't understand. What do you mean, spin it, spin it? And then he stopped and he said, horsey, nee. And he wanted to watch the movie Spin It, but he couldn't say it. But by pushing the language and by giving him that opportunity to use the few words he had, now he's trying to problem solve using other words in order to communicate.
Oh, look, it's...
And by doing that, now he's expanding a little bit more on his language, where his communication is still minimal, but still it's opening up doors for him.
Look, there's a whole lot more. We could have gone for the full hour on this one. I can hear it now. And I would have loved to have come back to you, Christine, on some of the results that you get through your work. We might talk about that further on another show. Sure. But can I thank you all for joining us? We were flooded with calls as well. Dr. Giacomo Vivanti, thank you.
Thank you.
From the Olga Tennison Autism Research Centre, where Dr. Nancy Sadker, mother of two children with autism, also works. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Christine Kendall, we'll get you back. Director of Spectrum Speech Pathology, thank you.
Pleasure.
And please share your experiences. Our listener feedback line 02833 1430, or get on our website and post a comment on this story. We would love to hear from you. You can email us from there too. Let's continue the conversation on our Facebook page as well. Lovely community of Life Matters listeners there every day. Coming up, the food we waste and how not to.
Last week on The Minefield with Mohsen Hamid, we tackled the problem of mass migration.
And when you build an attractive society, you shouldn't be surprised if it attracts people.
You see, when I hear Mohsen say that, all I can think of is films like Field of Dreams. I mean, who would have thought that cheesy B-grade flicks could explain the phenomenon of global migration?
You take that back, Scott. Field of Dreams is a masterpiece.
Much more than anything Plato produced.
Waleed Ali and Scott Stevens. The Minefield. This morning, 11:30, here on RN.
Coming up in a moment, we're going to hear about a pop-up cafe in Sydney which serves dishes made with ingredients otherwise destined for the landfill. First, though, we're heading now to France, where a brand new law passed this week which bans supermarkets from binning all that food that is approaching its use-by date. The law also bans the deliberate poisoning or bleaching of discarded food so that it can't be... And that's what supermarkets were doing, so that people couldn't retrieve the food from the bin because it was perceived to be a safety issue. So the man behind this huge shift is Arash Darambash. He's a municipal councillor in Courbevoie, northwest of Paris. He has made this law happen, and he joined us on the line a little earlier this morning.
There is a problem in France and other countries. We have got supermarkets, all the night, they throw out the garbage, most of 40 kilos of food. And in front of that, in the same time, we have got a middle class, very poor, and lots of homeless. That's why it was amazing that nobody do something about this situation. I was elected 1 year ago. When I came in front of the supermarket, I asked them, give me your food. I want to give it to the homeless and to the middle class.
And what was their response, Arash?
The answer was, it's not possible for you because you haven't got a cold room. And my idea was to take the food just before the close of the supermarket at 8:30, because the supermarket in France close at 9:00. And I take the food and I distribute, I give immediately the food at the same time to the middle class, just after to the homeless. That's why we didn't need a cold room.
Supermarkets in France were also bleaching food that they threw out, food that was otherwise edible, in order to prevent people from getting it from bins.
You know, the supermarkets are frightened against that somebody will be sick. But we haven't got the same interest, you know. I am politic. My interest is only the people, the citizen. The interest of the supermarket, I respect them, but their interest is to earn money. That's why I answer to them that we will help all the supermarkets, but they have to respect the law. The new law is that they are on the obligation to give all the food. They are not happy. The supermarkets are not happy, but they have got the obligation. If they don't want to apply this law, it will be a process against them, and it will be they have to pay contravention. That is the law.
What you managed to get from your local action in your council area in northwest of Paris, in the northwest of Paris, you then took that campaign nationally. 200,000 signatures, French film stars attaching their name to your cause. Within 4 months, a law is passed. Fabulous. What will the law require supermarkets to do?
The law is very simple. All them have got the obligation to give all the food that they want to waste it the night. No, they are under obligation to give to one association. Maybe you, me, or your friend can make an association, and they can go in front of the supermarket and say to the manager of the supermarket, the law is passed, you have to give us your food. It's very simple. This is very simple idea that all the countries can apply. In Africa, in India, but in Bangladesh, the impact is very important. Today on the world, we are 7 billion, but we are eating for the equivalent of 9 billion. We are not continue like that.
That's Arash Darambash. He's a municipal councillor in the northwest of Paris, and within 4 months, he basically convinced French politicians to implement a new law that, as we heard, will ban supermarkets from throwing out food near its use-by date, which is what they were doing. And he would like this to reach out across Europe. And he said to me this morning that he wants it to happen in Australia as well. It will be very interesting to see how the charitable sector in France responds to this new law, because, of course, they're going to be taking all that food from supermarkets and giving it to people who are in need of food. So how will they respond? That's a big new burden on them, and we'll be tracking that one with a lot of interest. But could we do it in Australia? And what about you? Do you eat food that others would otherwise throw out? You know, the squishy banana or the sad limp-looking carrot? Put yogurt slightly past its used-by date in your fridge? I mean, maybe yes, in your own fridge, but what about if it was served up to you in a restaurant? A blemished potato, a slightly wilting set of spinach leaves, would you send it back with complaint? Travis Harvey is a head chef with a difference. He's well-travelled, he's lived in Europe, he specialises in Mexican cuisine. He also has a passion for rescuing food and turning it into delicious cuisine, which he serves up to customers. For Life Matters, Pip Rasmussen took to the streets to visit Travis's new pop-up diner. It's called Harvested.
I'm standing on a relatively busy inner city street in Sydney outside a storefront that was previously vacant. But now it's a spot where meals are being served using food items headed for the rubbish dump. All right, I'm going to go inside.
I'm Trav Harvey. I'm the head chef for Oz Harvest. I've been with Oz Harvest for about 18 months. I started as an apprentice chef and moved on to, as soon as I became qualified, I moved over to Europe and started to spread my wings a little bit and learn a bit more about using food as a mechanism to change the world, I guess, in some small ways. And doing volunteer work, I became more involved in social justice and things like that.
Can you tell us about where the food is coming from that you're serving in your restaurant right now, Harvested?
Oz Harvest has 30 vans out on the road, refrigerator vans out on the road in Australia. And what they do is they basically run a service which picks up excess food from supermarkets, cafes, restaurants, importers, exporters, wholesalers, anybody that stores or sells food and has found that it is, for some reason, doesn't have a place in the market. So they call us. It might be something which is blemished. It might be something which is nearing its use-by date. It might be something which is past its best before date. And so essentially I'm just picking through what we regularly pick up, which is in the past 3 months, 340,000 kilos of food a month.
Service! Today's menu features pea and lettuce soup. Lettuce is one of the vegetables which has often gone to waste, so we're using it here in a soup, which is a little bit unusual, but it's very nice. We've got a pilaf, which is with spiced butternut, a house-dried fig and dried lemon crisps. We also have roast Brussels sprouts with broccoli, onion, toasted almond and tahini dressing, and this would have to be my favourite. Then next up we have the lamb and pine nut dumplings. They're served with spiced carrot, yogurt and tahini. They were a favourite yesterday. We have goat curd and smoked zucchini croquettes with beetroot aioli. And then a beautiful smoked baby eggplant served with grilled Witloff blue cheese dressing.
The stuff that comes through the door is not what people generally perceive to be refuse or rescued food. It's really high quality stuff, so that's what we're getting to work with.
When you were getting this all together, was there a lot of red tape that you have to go through to get restaurants and supermarkets to give you food, or was it relatively easy?
Oz Harvest really struggled in its early days to pick up food because of notions that different supermarkets and cafes and restaurants had about their liability for sending out food that would maybe become spoilt and then cause ill health to people. So Ronnie Carr, our CEO and founder, worked with the government to change the Civil Liability Act, which means that we have a lot of regulation in how we actually handle the food. So we have all of our drivers are trained in food safety handling, we have refrigerated vans, we have temperature control points, and of course we have the utmost care for all the people that will be receiving the food.
You just had a meal at Harvested. What did you think?
I thought it was fantastic. I would pay a lot more for food of this quality. It was creative, it was delicious, complex flavours, just exceeded my expectations.
Do you think there should be more effort made towards, you know, food rescue and stuff like that?
Oh, definitely. And I think they're, you know, doing a great thing by doing that, because it's incredible the amount of food that gets wasted, you know, from restaurants, from conferences and even supermarkets, you know.
I'm so hungry, and my good friends here just told me about this pop-up store, and it sounded like a great idea, a great concept, and happy to support it.
So you haven't eaten here before?
Never.
Do you have any idea of what you might choose on the menu?
I saw eggplant, some kind of Brussels sprout action. All of those things are good things.
We aren't paying any rent. All of the people that are standing around me now are volunteers, so everybody that sits down and eats a meal here is providing 30 meals to Australians in need by our metric of $1 equals 2 meals through OzHarvest. So we're taking basically one meal that we could hand out and turning it into 30 meals for people.
Where would the food end up if you didn't use it with OzHarvest?
Landfill. Essentially just landfill. But of course the environmental aspect of something like, for example, we have the lamb dumplings, which we're doing today, where you've got about 2 kilos of minced lamb. That represents about 100,000 litres of water for the production of that lamb. So we're talking about packaging, grain, the transport, abattoir, all of these aspects come into really consuming a lot of resources that people don't generally know about, that sort of stuff. So when you're talking about 2 kilos of lamb into landfill, we're talking about a pretty extraordinary amount of effect on the environment as well.
What kind of responses have you had to the pop-up donor so far?
The reaction has been enormous. So we sold out on our first date. We opened at 11:30 and we were out of food by 1:30. We're really happy that a lot of the people that are coming have not had a lot to do with OzHarvest before and are new to the concept and learning something about it. So we love that our supporters come and help us out, but preaching to the converted is not the mission here. To be able to expand our message and have new people consider what it is that we're doing and how they can become involved or even change their own practices is what it's all about. If you give people these options to buy something which is supposedly second rate, but it is just maybe needs to be peeled in a different way because it might be a wonky sweet potato instead of a straight one, people will buy that. People are accepting of that, and that is changing. Our culture is certainly changing.
Do you think it's possible that other places in Sydney or around Australia could do this food saving initiative?
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot more going on in food saving than people realise. There's most chefs do try to throw out absolutely the smallest amount they possibly can. It's their bottom line. It's how they pay their bills, by being smart about what they do with the odds and ends that they have come out of their production. So there is really, in a good kitchen, that's what's going on. But in so much as being able to use rescued stuff, I guess that we are so blessed in being able to pick up so much and have such a variety of things to come through. Like, we've got baby Brussels sprouts and organic broccoli today that we're roasting to make a little salad. To get that, you know, just come through, kilos and kilos of it to come through the door so I can make a beautiful dish out of it, is something that I suppose a lot of other places would have a challenge with. But it's really up to the public to attend these places and to accept that this rescued food is part of a whole problem around our culture as aesthetes and looking at the sort of presentation of products and their little blemishes and deciding not to accept them on that basis rather than accepting that, you know, food has nutritional content, it has seasons, it has all these aspects to it. If people change their mind about consuming those sort of goods, then restaurants like this could pop up.
Was it your experience when you were travelling around the world as a chef, like you said?
I spent 2.5 years in Mexico, about 1.5 years in Guatemala as well, and I would say those would be the places that really changed. I mean, in Europe, you do see much more of a tradition of drying, preserving, and really working with the seasons because they're stable in their produce, and most of their produce is from where they are. Most of ours doesn't quite have the history, so I guess culturally we don't quite do the same thing to the same extent. But certainly in Guatemala, I remember teaching nutrition and cooking to a women's association, and I was teaching them how to make a chicken stock. And when I strained the chicken stock and I went to throw out the vegetables and the bones, they all looked aghast and grabbed all of those veggies off me and picked them apart and put them in their bags and took them home. And those sort of things you don't realise when you're in the habit of learning in a kitchen what other ways to move forward with food production. You generate waste without even thinking about it. So it was those cultural experiences that really changed the way that I thought about food. I'm loving the space, I'm loving people's reaction to it, and I'm loving being able to change it as we go along each day. So, yeah, it's a dream, honestly.
How brilliant is that? Travis Harvey, head chef at Harvested, a new pop-up diner in Sydney, using food that would otherwise be thrown out. And he was talking to Pip Rasmussen for Life Matters. On July 27th, look out for Oz Harvest's campaign Think, Eat, Save. As part of that, they're going to be serving up food across the nation. They're going for 5,000 people in Martin Place in Sydney. If you live in a rural area and you're looking to volunteer to stop good food being thrown away, Oz Harvest run REAP. And we've popped details on the Life Matters website about that. And someone rang in about a Victorian initiative called Fair Share, rescuing food, fighting hunger. Books and arts coming up next. What's on?
Oh, we're going to look at Aboriginal art. We're going to look at art that puts the Aboriginal body, the Aboriginal person in the frame for political effect. In fact, I'm looking at a sleek cow on which is sitting an Aboriginal man right now.
That will be very powerful, Michael. That's coming up straight after the news and much more with Michael Cathcart, Books and Arts. Bye.